Good morning, everyone, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for you today. My guest will be Lacey Gechter. She is a founder and president of Simple Foods, and she is a fellow at the Center for a Livable Future at Johns Hopkins University. And she is also the development and communications manager for Waterkeepers Chesapeake. And she'll be coming on in a little bit, but first I want to share with you some things going on in our area and some things in the news that I'm sure you want to know about. First off, just want to remind you, tonight is the Coalition for Healthy School Foods Gala, which is a great event. It's their annual fundraiser that brings money into this nonprofit organization that is working to improve school food throughout the country. It used to be called the New York Coalition, but now that it's gone national, it's just the Coalition. And they are actually responsible for two completely plant-based schools in Queens that are feeding kids just plant-based food. And they are honoring this year at their fundraiser four filmmakers who have made, you know, impactful films. One is Forks Over Knives, one is Lunch Hour, one is Plant Pure Nation, and one is Veducated. All these films are really worth seeing, and they really just talk about the benefits of eating a more plant-based diet. And if you've never gone to the gala, it's really fun. It's, you know, 4 hours or 3 hours of delicious vegan food made by everybody who makes vegan food around the city. So it's really a wonderful event. So if you can make it, that's tonight. Let's see. I am busy working on the Long Island Food Conference. I've been talking about that for weeks already, but I just want to remind you all that that's coming up on November 2nd and 3rd. I also know there's also a food tech conference going on same day, so bad timing on our part, because a lot of what we both are talking about is the same, except we're really focusing on more food as medicine and how food impacts one's health. And so on November 2nd, we're just doing a pre-conference film screening of the documentary film, What the Health. And following the film, we've invited Dr. Charles Van to come and lead us in a discussion and Q&A. And so it should be a wonderful evening to get our weekend started. And then on Saturday is the actual food conference, and the title and theme of that is Food as a Solution. And we all know who are involved in the food movement that food is more than just feeding our own bodies. It also is responsible for taking care of our planet or destructing our planet. And it's amazing how much of the greenhouse gas emissions and global footprint our industrial agricultural system has on our planet. And I'm sure we'll be talking about that a little bit later with my guest as well. But this conference really, really wants to focus on that. And so there's, we have invited Frances Moore Lappe as our keynote speaker, and she is wonderful. Her book, Diet for a Small Planet, really changed my life, the whole trajectory of my life starting when I was 16. Her book, Diet for a Small Planet, was so ahead of its time, really connecting the fact that we use so much of our land to grow food, to feed animals, when animals can feed so fewer people than the plants that we're growing. It just really rang true to me back when I was in high school, and I've never turned back. I'm not 100% vegan, but I eat a lot of plant-based food, and that's the primary source of my diet. You know, however, being on this food journey for so many years, over 40 years now, you know, I've really come to kind of take the middle path, like the Buddha, I guess, just knowing that everyone has to find their way and you have to meet people where they're at. And with love, encourage people to go into their own consciousness and ethics and really do the right thing. If someone is eating meat at every meal, it's just taking too many resources from our fragile planet. And it's just not right. And yet, if you eat it on occasion and you source it from people that are really trying to grow or raise animals in a humane way, It's different. And so this conference is really just trying to bring thoughtfulness to all of our actions so that we are making good, responsible, ethical choices when we choose the food that we eat. And so after our keynote speaker, Francis Moore Lappe, we have four different panels. One is on food policy and justice. And, you know, we'll be talking about how the Farm Bill impacts our food system. We'll also be talking about local policies. And we'll also be talking about food justice, race, and how that impacts our food system and the access to good, healthy food. And it's a conversation that sometimes is difficult to have, but it's one that needs to happen. Very often we, you know, don't want to bring social inequality into the discussion, and yet we can't really avoid it. And so Karen Washington will be joining us on that panel to talk about food justice. Tom Colicchio will be on that panel talking about his work when he founded the Food Network Action, or Food Policy Action, I'm sorry, Food Policy Action. And then the following panel will be on food as medicine. And we'll be talking with Dr. Robert Graham, who is a Harvard-trained integrative medicine doctor who actually just finished a 9-month training at the Natural Gourmet Institute to learn how to cook healthy, because he realized that in order to really be a good doctor in today's world, one needs to be able to prescribe food as medicine and get people eating well and how that really impacts their health. And so I'm really happy to see that he will be able to join us, and having watched what he's been doing in his world, it's really great. Ellen Kamai, also known as the Natural Nurse, also a guest on this wonderful radio station. Not a guest, I'm sorry, a host on this radio station. She is a genius when it comes to botanical pharmacology, and she just knows everything about herbs and foraging, and she's a wealth of information. She will be sharing her knowledge with us. And then Sally Fallon Morrell is the founder of the Weston Price Foundation, who's been promoting raw dairy and bone broth as a healing method as well. And so she'll be on sharing her philosophy about eating for health. And then we have a panel on growing food, where we are representing a large commercial size CSA. CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture, and Fred Lee from Sangley Farms will be joining us. We have Michael Doyle coming to talk to us about aquaculture. We have Fran Whittlesey from Gateway Community Gardens talking about community gardens, and Stefan Oberman from Arrow Farms talking about hydroponics. They opened a huge factory size hydroponic system in Newark, New Jersey, where there was access to very little good fresh vegetables, and they're changing the access right there in Newark, New Jersey, and the local region. So they will be joining us. And I forgot one other panel. Which one? Oh, food and climate change. How could I forget that? Food and climate change. And we have someone from NOFA coming. Tristan Stewart from Feedback will be here talking about food rescue and, how much food we waste. Which has been really in the news a lot lately. So it's going to be a great event. Breakfast and plant-based lunch is included in the day. So I hope you come. We've priced the tickets really reasonable. Early bird pricing is still available. It's only 30 days for the full day, including your breakfast and lunch. So buy your tickets now before October 21st, which is right around the corner. And then I am also gearing up for my 24th annual Coat Drive and Community Cooking event, which is a Thanksgiving feast for people who do not have as much as we have. And it is for, we partner with the Riverfund Food Pantry, which is one of the most amazing organizations that I know of. They serve more homeless and hungry people in New York than any other food pantry. And they have a mobile food pantry. So every 2 weeks, they are bringing food to Rufus King Park and distributing food to hungry people in that area. And every year for the past 24 years, I Eat Green partners with them, and we show up with food, enough food for 800 people, actually enough food for 1,000 people, but there's usually about 800 people that show up in the park, and then they distribute the remainder, any leftover food, to shelters in the area. But a part of this is also a coat collection, and we try to collect coats and jackets, sweatshirts, blankets, scarves, hats, anything to help people who don't have heat to stay warm during the winter, whether they're sleeping on the street or they're sleeping in a dilapidated apartment that doesn't have good heat, whatever the situation is, they need some clothing to keep them warm. So we are starting our coat collection. So if anybody has any coats in the area, I know that this show is not just the New York area. So if you're not in the New York area but you have coats, there's hungry people and homeless people everywhere. So find a place to donate your coats to. And you can drop them off if you are in the New York area at the IE Green Homestead. And just send me an email at bhavani@IEGreen, and I will give you directions. And there's also a sign up on my website if you want to volunteer to cook for this event. It's a wonderful community effort. I gather over 100 people that come through my home over the weekend cooking, and we're scrubbing hundreds of pounds of potatoes in the bathtub, and people are chopping together, cooking together, having fun. There's a little crayon station set up for young children who can make cards for the people that are homeless. And so there's something for everyone to do. So it's really a wonderful event. So I do hope you can come to that. And now I just want to share with you my recipe for the week. It's a very simple recipe, but oh so delicious and oh so good for you. I talked about it a couple of weeks ago when Dana Cohn was on talking about her book, Quench. So many of us are not fully hydrated, and chia seeds are one of the superfoods that she talked about as being so hydrating. And so this is a vanilla chia pudding that you can make for breakfast, but it's so delicious. You can actually have it, dress it up and have it as a dessert as well. So, and it's very easy to make. So I started with 1/4 cup chia seeds. This is good for 2 people. 1/4 cup of chia seeds, 1 tablespoon pure organic maple syrup, 1 cup of unsweetened organic coconut milk, but you can use your favorite non-dairy milk. You know, you can even mix it up. Coconut milk is a little fattier than some of the other milks that you might choose, like an almond milk. So you can do half and half if you'd like. 1 teaspoon of vanilla extract, 1 pinch of salt, 1 sprinkle of cinnamon, and 1 sprinkle of cardamom. And this you can adjust at the end depending on your taste. You know, 1/4 teaspoon just seems like a little bit too much, but 1 sprinkle might be a little bit too little. So taste it after you make it, and you can always add some more cinnamon or cardamom. But those flavors go really well together and makes this really a special pudding. And then toppings, you can add on berries, raspberries, blackberries, blueberries. You can add on nuts, any kind of nuts you want, dried fruit. You can also add 1 tablespoon of peanut butter to this if you want, and top it with some sliced banana. So there's a lot of creativity that can go into this, but let me give you the directions of how to make it. You're going to pour the unsweetened organic coconut milk into a large measuring cup and add the other liquids, the maple syrup, the vanilla extract, then add the pinch of salt and the shake of cinnamon and cardamom and mix that together, and then pour in the chia seeds. Actually, I'm sorry, before you do that, I took an immersion blender because you know how coconut milk, the kind that comes in a can, very often has clumps of fat in it. And so you want to either skim that off or blend it up so that it's so that the chunks are not there. So I used an immersion blender into the measuring cup and just pureed that so it was all smooth. And then I poured that mixture into the 1/4 cup of chia seeds that I had put into a small mixing bowl. And then just mix that up and mix it up really well. Put a lid on it and put it in the refrigerator and let it sit for at least 30 minutes. But the longer it sits, the more congealed it becomes and the better. I actually let it sit overnight. So I recommend putting this together in the evening, putting it in the refrigerator. After 30 minutes, come back to it, give it another stir. In the morning, you'll give it another stir as well, and then it's ready to go. That's it. As I said, you can add those extra things to it. You can also add some more maple syrup if you like it a little sweeter. But it's really delicious, and it's really such an easy recipe and is so healthy. It's really something you should put into your regular schedule for breakfasts. So now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Lacey Gichter. She is the founder and president of Simple Foods and a fellow at the Center for a Livable Future. And she is the development and communications manager for Waterkeeper Chesapeake. And her organization, Simple Foods, mission is to promote a diet that is healthy for people, animals, and the planet. And they use education, outreach, and advocacy to encourage action on a personal level, one individual at a time. And she's currently pursuing her Doctor of Public Health degree in Environmental Health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, where she is a Center for a Livable Future Learner Fellow. Her professional background is primarily environmental nonprofits, and she most recently worked on renewable energy projects on the Native American reservations, especially in the Great Plains and Rocky Mountains. She has her master's in kinesiology and health from the University of Wyoming. And her studies focus on the similarities and differences between the tactics used by big business and big agriculture and what the best way to combat these tactics are. And so she strives to advocate for an ethical food system, as so many of us do, and it's my pleasure to introduce all of you to Lacey. Lacey, are you with me?
I am. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Thank you so much for coming in today and joining us. I want to start by, can you first tell us a little bit about your company, Simple Foods?
Sure. It's an organization I founded with some very talented friends in 2010 in Fort Collins, Colorado, where I lived at the time. And as the mission implies, the organization is really geared towards supporting individuals in transitioning to sustainable, healthy, humane diets, more plants, less animals. And Simple Foods really represents just one of the strategies that I think are really important for changing our food system, and that's building the grassroots support for changes in the food system.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, Slow Food, which is an organization I'm very involved in right now, have been for years. They have a promotion going on right now, Make a Change, and they're really encouraging people to make three changes this week. There's actually Food for Change campaign. And they're asking people to take three actions. One is cooking only using local ingredients, a week of not eating any meat, and a week to reduce your food waste to zero. And I want to invite people, I forgot to mention that earlier, to jump in on that, because that's so much a part of what we'll be talking about together, because our food system is so primarily heavy on meat and producing food that is not really sustainable. And so I know you've been focusing on our food system, and I thought maybe you could share with us what you see as the ideal U.S. food system.
Yeah, the vision of the U.S. food system that I'm working toward is one in which farms simply look like most people think they look. And so probably most of your listeners know, Bhavani, that about 95% of the food we as Americans eat really come from industrial agriculture that, as you said, does not include sustainable practices. And really just the crops that we raise and the animals that we raise in those systems just do not look like what most people think and want those crops to look like. And my whole goal is to change that so that our expectations of where our food comes from is accurate.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you all, I'm sure you get this all the time. People are saying, yeah, but we're going to have, you know, 9 billion people in 2050. You know, how are we going to feed all of them? You know, we need GMOs and industrial factory farms to feed all those people. And you and I probably know that's not true. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So I'm studying at Johns Hopkins at the moment. And quickly, I am supposed to say that the views I express in this interview do not reflect the views of Johns Hopkins or the Center for Livable Future, where I'm a fellow. But one of the coolest things I got to do at Hopkins has been to take a class on population growth. And just as a sort of aside to this conversation, I've always suspected that the 9 billion people by 2050 number was probably way lower than it should be. And in that population dynamics class, I had that confirmed. It's really, no one can predict the future, but it seems like a pretty vast underestimate of how many people to expect, given that we had about 2 billion people 70 years ago, and we now have 7 billion people to contribute additional population growth. But getting back to the issue of food, yeah, so this is the concept that we need industrial agriculture practices to feed the world is a really, really important myth in our food system. There's actually interesting studies about how entrenched and important that myth is for the farmers who are stuck in this industrial system. And so it's really an important part of getting them on board with these practices that are harmful to the farmers themselves and their communities and to people who eat the food. It's really important that the industry convinces farmers that they need to use these practices in order to feed the world. I think that the most powerful statistic to combat this myth is that currently, right now, about 70% of food consumed in the world comes from peasant farming that's done on 1 acre or less of land. So industrial agriculture is not currently meeting most of the world's food needs. And in the United States, really, our whole food system is driven by an attempt to get rid of the extra calories we produce, which is obviously in complete contradiction to we have to use these methods to feed the world. So we produce many more calories and every nutrient, every micronutrient, protein, fat, we produce way more of these nutrients that we need. And for example, corn, which is the number one subsidized crop in the United States, the only corn that receives those subsidies that we eat is in the form of high fructose corn syrup. The rest of that corn goes to feed animals, as you said, to feed cars for ethanol, and then for industrial products like paint. So we're really trying to figure out what to do with all this extra food that we produce, and we absolutely do not need to keep producing food this way to feed the world.
Mm. Yeah, none of those subsidies really go to any of those small farmers, right, to help them with the devastation that happens with a drought or climate change or things that happen. It's really going to these industrial farmers who are not really growing, like you said, the food that we eat, that we need. So is there anything we can do about that? How can we rectify that? I said, how can we rectify that?
Yeah, so, well, as a scientist, I just need to say that some of the subsidies do go to small farmers, especially in the form of crop insurance. It is inaccurate to say that none of the subsidies go to small farmers. What is accurate to say is that the vast, vast majority, over 99%, go to commodity crops, which can be grown by small farmers, but again, we're typically not growing them with the priority of feeding humans in mind. And so to rectify that, a small question for Thursday morning. what I see as the most important lever is really reducing the amount of food that we produce so that there is not such a need to get rid of those calories. And then the number one argument that comes in there is that if we produce less food, so supply decreases, which means prices increase. But the science is very clear that what subsidies do is lower prices for food manufacturers. So if you've ever seen the USDA's food dollar, it's something like 15 cents on the dollar goes to farmers, and the remaining 85% goes to marketing. And that marketing means putting your oats into a package with a picture on it that says oatmeal, or turning your oats into cookies or whatever. But so that 85%, that's a profit margin that's created for this very small number of food conglomerates to make profits off of the food that they get as cheap and then sell back to us, the eaters, for basically the same price we would be paying without the subsidies, but instead we're paying for that marketing. So if we can create a system that doesn't allow for marketers to make that money in between farmers and the people they feed, food prices don't have to go up, but we do need the supply of food to go down.
Mm-hmm. But do we have an oversupply of food being grown, of the food that we eat, or is the majority of the food being grown the food that is not for human consumption, it's for animal consumption? And are we growing the right amount that we need for that animal consumption? Do we need that much? Because, you know, you hear about them, you know, cutting down the rainforest to create more grazing land for the animals. I mean, you know, it just seems like that's an endless cycle right there.
Well, it does have an end, but I don't think it's one that we want to reach in our lifetime.
Right.
So we do overproduce food for humans in the United States. And that really bears out, especially in terms of food waste, which is something that the Center for a Livable Future studies quite extensively. And it's something around 40% of all food that we produce in the United States is wasted.
Unbelievable, huh?
It's very impressive. So we do overproduce the foods that humans eat, as well as foods that we then feed to animals or machines or other industrial processes. And I guess my personal opinion is I'm in full support of continuing to overproduce foods that people eat, just not at the quantities that we do, including instead of producing corn for cars and cows, to produce an amount of corn that is reasonable to feed humans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's why I know you mentioned, you know, corn. High fructose corn syrup. I mean, they just created that product to kind of use up what they're growing, you know. And then they also, you know,
Absolutely.
Are pushing us all to eat way more food than we need, like you said, you know, to consume more calories, which is, you know, feeds on the obesity epidemic and helps keep us sick because there's so much money in that for them. You know, the film
Indeed.
That we're screening. Have you seen the film that, What the Health? Have you seen that film?
I have.
You have, you know, it's just, you know, just kind of really talks about the revolving door and the connections and the reason that there's no incentive to really get us healthier because they would, you know, lose so much money. So, So we have to kind of take that control into our own hands, it seems like. I mean, if I know we haven't touched on the food policy yet, or the farm bill, actually, which, you know, really shapes so much of our food system and how it runs. But maybe we should take a couple-minute break first, and then when we come back, maybe we can talk a little bit about the farm policy, because I know they're debating that right now, and that shapes so much of our food system, and so many people don't even know what the farm bill does or how it impacts us. So how's that sound?
That sounds like a good plan.
Okay. So, everyone, we're going to take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the farm bill. I'm talking with Lacey Gechter about food, and you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green. We'll be right back.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, the founder of the Progressive Radio Network. Today, we have more than 80 producers bringing forth the most progressive and most liberating information, the kind of information you do not regularly hear on any of the mainstream or alternative media. You can help us now. Up to this point, I have virtually supported the Progressive Radio Network, all of its expenses and payroll, myself. But we would like to expand our reach. We'd like to do far more. We'd like to be able to advertise on Facebook and let others know we exist. We are the number one progressive radio network in the world. In fact, we have programs that are most listened to in all of progressive radio. But we could go a lot further. Our message could reach a lot more people, especially at a time when people are desperate for honest, objective insights on the important topical issues of our day. How can you help? It's simple. Go to prn.fm, go to our main page. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a little button, Support Now. And then whatever you can contribute on a monthly basis will make a big difference. It will help get the message out. It will help inform more people, give them more choices. This is where you'll hear in the independent candidates and the people looking to challenge the corruption in government and industries. But we need to get our reach out further. So please, whatever you can afford on a monthly basis, and there's some suggestions there, and it'll be automatic. All right? Thank you very much for continuing to help us help you and the rest of the world on these important issues.
Everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and my guest today is Lacey Gechter, founder and president of Simple Foods and a fellow at the Center for a Livable Future. Lacey, you with me?
I'm still here.
Great. So right before the break, we touched on the Farm Bill, and I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that. I know it's currently under debate in Congress, but maybe you could share with us how that affects shaping our food system going forward.
I'd love to. If it's okay, I'll start with a very brief history of why the Farm Bill looks like it looks today.
Sure.
And that is because, thank you, in the Great Depression and then leading up to World War II, in the United States, of course, we had the Dust Bowl that really led to legitimate famine, widespread famine in this country. So, of course, now we have high rates of food insecurity, but famine is pretty rare. But so in the 1930s, we really had famine. And gearing up toward to World War II, there was a lack of men at that time who could serve in the military. So we had insufficiently healthy men to serve in our military because of poor nutrition in the United States. And so the Farm Bill, the first Farm Bill, had two purposes. One was to help farmers get back in business after losing their farms to the Dust Bowl or the economic recession. And two was to get as many calories as possible to U.S. citizens. So we were really trying to both support farmers and get food to people. And our Farm Bill today still does a pretty good job of doing that. Of course, we're supporting an increasingly small number of farmers who are producing the majority of our food in this industrial system. But the Farm Bill still supports farmers who, at current food prices, again, getting 15 cents on the U.S. dollar, commodity farmers couldn't survive without Farm Bill subsidies. And then the Farm Bill is also really good at getting the maximum number of calories out to the public in these various forms. And as you said, what that currently looks like in our country is an epidemic of obesity. And ironically, at this point, there's statements that you can Google from U.S. Army generals asking for a large-scale overhaul of the Farm Bill to recognize that we went from being unfit to serve in the Great Depression due to famine to now being too fat to serve because we're again running into the problem of people in the not being able to join the military because now of obesity instead of because of famine. Should I take a pause there?
No, keep going
with the current Farm Bill.
Keep going.
Okay. So, at this point, the majority of farm subsidies in the Farm Bill actually come in the form of subsidized crop insurance. And that's a really fascinating public-private partnership wherein there is one private company that provides all the federally subsidized crop insurance to farmers. And basically, that private company profits off of the premiums paid into the crop insurance program, and the U.S. taxpayers pay the bills for that private insurance company if prices drop or if there's crop loss and farmers need to make a claim against their insurance policy. So that is how the majority of Farm Bill subsidies work today. And again, those subsidies are geared toward supporting the crops with the highest calories because that really genuinely made good sense in the late 1920s, 1930s, and leading up to World War II. We were trying to maximize calories. And so those are referred to as commodity crops, corn, soy, wheat, sorghum, pulses, which are beans, basically, legumes. It might be prudent for me to note that actually about 80% of the Farm Bill is funding for SNAP, which was formerly called food stamps. And so then the rest of that, approximately 20%, is going to support farmers more directly.
Mm-hmm. And I know there's a big push from, I think it's the House that wanted to cut the SNAP really intensely. The Senate is trying to, I guess they're negotiating that right now. Do you know where that stands? And why is SNAP even a part of the Farm Bill as opposed to some part of, instead of another social services bill? Why did they put SNAP in the Farm Bill?
That goes back to the history of the Farm Bill, which was meant as this two birds with one stone concept, paying farmers to farm high-calorie crops and then giving those high-calorie crops to people who couldn't afford food on their own. And the original food stamps were, in fact, paper stamps that you could trade in for bulk commodity foods like corn, soy, wheat, back when we ate those things. So it was a physical food stamp that you exchanged for these commodities that the government was subsidizing to be grown. Mm-hmm. And so the Farm Bill, again, was originally meant to do both things, support farmers and feed people without access to adequate food. The reason, well, there might be much more complicated political reasons why SNAP is still in the Farm Bill, but the overarching theory behind why it has stayed in the Farm Bill is because typically Republican districts support agriculture subsidies and Democratic districts support food stamps or SNAP. And so keeping these two programs merged is how we've managed to pass a farm bill approximately every 5 years since approximately 1930.
Mm-hmm. So confusing. And I know you said that your philosophy on the food system differs from the Center for a Livable Future. The name Center for a Livable Future seems like it would be on par with what you're, everything you're saying, but obviously, it's not. Can you share us how it differs? Share with us how it differs.
Oh, so there isn't a difference. I don't actually know what the. I don't think that the Center for a Livable Future actually has a unified model of their vision of how the food system works. I simply was asked to say that what I say does not necessarily reflect the views of the Center for a Livable Future. So that was just the classic media disclaimer.
Okay.
Even though I am associated with the center as a Center for a Livable Future Learner Fellow, but my model of the U.S. food system is different than that of a lot of people that I interact with, and the general concept that I hear is that consumer demand drives the food system and subsidies lower the prices of certain foods to consumers, increasing the amount of those foods that we eat. Everything that I see in the dominant U.S. food system is really best explained as an answer to the question, how do we get rid of all these calories? So I see it as a really supply-side driven system where we as consumers, humans, citizens, are really told what we need to eat in order to get rid of the maximum amount of calories. And I think that's really evident, as you said, in obesity and other health outcome rates, and also just the fact that we try so hard to get rid of our calories in different ways, like feeding calories to animals, feeding calories to cars, shipping calories overseas, which sometimes is really needed and often is really just a way of flooding other countries' markets with cheap U.S. foods.
And then it hurts those local farmers, too, so it's not really good for the people there very often.
Exactly. And again, sometimes international food aid is absolutely essential and the moral thing to do. But what we really have now is an international system in which the rest of the world becomes sort of a dumping ground for the extra calories produced in the United States, which then suppresses local markets, as you said.
Mm-hmm. You know, the one not bright, like there's not enough demand, but you can see how consumer demands for organic and healthy food is also driving the market. I mean, just by all these food conglomerates trying to buy up the organic companies because they see that's,
yep,
you know, that's where the growth is. People are starting to, you know, or many people are starting to take this issue into their own hearts and trying to change their diet and push for healthier food, and you can see that. I mean, when I started eating, you know, more plant-based food and vegetarian food, you couldn't even shop in a regular supermarket. You couldn't find tofu there. You couldn't find organic there. I ran a food co-op out of my home for 10 years because That was the only way I could get organic vegetables. And so, you know, it's, you can see how the changes, however, there's also downsides to that. You know, the, you know, when those big conglomerates buy up the companies that are trying to do the right thing, often the model then changes, right? And,
indeed.
You know, yeah. So, another thing I know that you've been focusing on is, the marketing. Like you said, so much of the marketing, so much of that food, USDA food dollar goes towards the marketing, and you've been really looking at some of the similarities between how big tobacco did their marketing and big ag. Can you talk a little bit about those similarities?
I'd be happy to. So really, there's nothing particularly unique about the quote-unquote big ag industry. Basically, every extractive industry, at least in the United States, has really followed the playbook written by big tobacco in the 20th century. I'm not an expert, but many people attribute modern marketing practices to big tobacco, you know, implying or directly stating that big tobacco really developed marketing as we know it today, and sort of this extremely strategic and effective creation of demand. So tobacco was a relatively rare product in households until the invention of the cigarette, which only took off once these big tobacco conglomerates launched massive marketing campaigns. So there was no sort of latent demand for cigarettes, but these marketing campaigns really tied cigarettes to the U.S. identity, identities of masculinity, things like that, to great effect, of course. And so, like I said, almost every large exploitive industry now copies the big tobacco playbook. Big ag is no exception. There's obviously concerted efforts to create demand for these products that get rid of calories for our dominant food system. I'm sure you're familiar with the USDA checkoff program, which is a program wherein food industry participants pay into this federal program that then turns around with these huge marketing campaigns for the food specific to that industry. So the largest checkoff campaigns are for dairy, pork, beef, chicken, and then avocado, which, good for avocado. It's not good to stay in there. Mm-hmm. And so if you've seen the Got Milk ads, the newer Milk Life ads, pork, the other white meat, beef, it's what's for dinner, those are all government checkoff programs that are, again, this very strategic method for building demand for these products. And it might be worth mentioning that the reason why feeding calories to animals before we eat those animals or their milk or eggs is because for every, let's say, 10 calories you put in to feeding a cow, you get one calorie out when you eat that cow, because the cow is using the other 9 calories to live, putting off heat, basal metabolism. And so it's an extremely good way of getting rid of calories if you want to feed 10 of them to a cow and come out the other end with us only being able to eat one of those calories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. No, I did not realize that there was, am not familiar with the checkoff program. I do know, you know, of course, the marketing power that these companies have. I mean, you know, having worked in school food and see, you know, and watched Michelle Obama, you know, try to improve school food, and the pushback from, you know, the French fry organization and the dairy organization,
mm-hmm.
the pizza conglomerates. I mean, they all have their own huge powerful, you know, lobbyists and marketers. And it's amazing that we can't improve things because of the power that these lobbying groups have. I think the American Dairy Association still is responsible for paying for the health education in public schools. So you know it's going to be slanted. You know, it's just amazing, you know, and I don't think people realize that when they see this marketing. And do you look into the marketing towards children specifically? Because I know that's been a real issue and, you know, it's been up for debate, and I don't know where the laws are standing right now for that. Are you familiar with that at all?
I am familiar with it. Familiar is a good word. Definitely not expert on it. But yeah, it's, again, just as with tobacco ads, Joe Camel targeting children, food companies really target children to try to build this demand at an early age. And studies have shown it's extremely effective. Children are very susceptible to advertising, although all of us are really very susceptible to advertising. Advertising works really well. If we think that we're too smart to be susceptible to advertisements, then we're actually not smart enough to realize how effective marketing is. So there are efforts to ban advertising of certain products to children. And last I knew, those efforts had been passed but never enforced. That was the last I knew.
Yeah, the last I heard it was like voluntary. You know, companies
exactly.
were recognizing it, and so they were voluntarily going to change it. But, I mean, we all know that if it's not a regulation, if it's not a law, you know, they're not really going to voluntarily cut their sales. So,
well, and it needs to be a law that is enforced and backed up with enforcement power, which it is not as it stands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. So what advice do you give to my conscientious consumers out there?
Well, I did want to be sure and say that thing that I think is most important about recognizing that big agriculture companies are using the same tactics as big tobacco companies have used is that we also have a playbook for dealing with those tactics. So in the United States, the anti-smoking campaign of the 20th century reduced smoking rates by over half between 1965 and 2017. So that's a huge shift, obviously, in that tobacco market and in public health. It wasn't perfect. There's a lot of big tobacco issues we just shipped overseas, and it was also sort of successful along race and socioeconomic status. But it is an example, it does give us example of really successful tactics that we can take. And so a lot of what worked in big tobacco was, of course, public education marketing to counter big tobacco marketing. Also lawsuits to hold the tobacco companies accountable, which is an area at Waterkeepers Chesapeake, where I'm the development and communications manager. Waterkeepers Chesapeake does an excellent job stepping in with litigation to hold big ag companies accountable for the pollution that they're causing. So marketing, litigation, groundswell of support from the public. This involves, a key component of reducing smoking rates was actually convincing medical doctors that smoking was bad for their patients, which was an uphill battle because most medical doctors at the time smoked. And of course, mm-hmm. we have a similar phenomenon with diet right now, where most mm-hmm. medical doctors are part of the dominant food system. And so it's hard to convince those doctors that what they're eating is bad for them and therefore bad for their patients. And I think probably the most important thing for conscientious consumers in taking all these lessons into account is that it's really important not to think of yourself as a consumer, but as a citizen who's civically engaged. There's a pretty cool food citizen project going on at the Center for a Livable Future that is Googleable if you want to check that out. So it's really important to hold your representatives accountable, be active,
and vote. And
commenting on policy, that sort
right.
of thing.
Right.
Definitely vote.
So maybe you can share that really quick because we're just about out of time. And I'll, of course, share it on my website, too. What is that?
The Food Citizen Project?
Mm-hmm.
It's a project at the Center for a Livable Future that's designed
so just go to their website.
Unify people around food issues in the civic sector. And yes, it's, honestly, the URL is very annoying, but you can look it up at the Center for a Livable Future Food Citizen Project.
Perfect. Well, Lacey, we are out of time, but thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with us and coming on the show. It's really been delightful. And everyone out there listening, thank you so much for joining us. It's been great. I want to make sure you get out and vote. That's coming up, and help others to vote. That's the way we're going to change this around. Thanks again, and I'll see you all again next week. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Bye for now.
Thanks, Bhavani.